and welcome to a very special episode of Finogo FinTalks, recorded live at Money 2020 in Amsterdam. Today I'm joined by investigative reporter Dan McCrum from the Financial Times.
Hello!
Hello. Who recently, well, not so recently, but reported on the story of Wirecard and the huge fraud being perpetrated in Germany by this company. Dan, thank you so much for joining me. For anyone who's not familiar with your international story, let's say, could you tell them a little bit about yourself and who you are and what you've been doing?
Great, yeah. So my name's Dan McCrum. I'm a reporter for the Financial Times, and I do investigations. Yeah. And the one I'm probably best known for is this little German company called Wirecard, which used to call itself Germany's PayPal, did something to do with payments, and it became one of the biggest tech companies in Europe, worth almost $30 billion. And it turned out the whole thing was a top-to-bottom fraud. But in the course of trying to expose this, quite a lot of strange stuff happened. And so the more I dug into it, the weirder things got. Private detectives start following people around. Hackers are trying to break into our email, other people's. My boss gets offered a $10 million bribe if he can make the stories go away. And then as everything heats up and we try and draw people's attention to this thing is a fraud, look at the evidence. The German government piles in and instead of investigating the company, starts investigating me and my colleagues on this idea that we have leaked our stories to speculators. And the reason the Financial Times is writing about this one German company is just to help these nasty speculators profit rather than trying to expose the truth, which does very eventually come out that, yes, it is a fraud and it collapses very quickly.
Amazing. Thanks so much for that introduction, Dan. So I very recently watched your documentary, your Netflix documentary.
Scandal.
Scandal in preparation for this. And It's a great story. I genuinely recommend everyone go and watch it or read your book, which was also fantastic. But it was really just a mind-blowing story to see this huge criminal enterprise that and the efforts being put into it and what it really took to take it down. Because I think the documentary clocks in around 90 minutes, but this was years of your life, right?
6 years it took. I mean, so the first time I get the tip was all the way back in 2014. And I'm chatting to this hedge fund manager and he just says to me, "Hey, Dan, would you be interested in some German gangsters?" Like, yes, of course. And yeah, and then 6 years later, it finally collapses. So, yeah, no, it leaves you with that question, like, why didn't people see what we saw?
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting, right? And that was one of the things that really struck me when I was watching Scandal, which is that so many people were protecting Wirecard, and not necessarily people who were in the know, but people who just wanted it to be real. So the regulator, BaFin, was very clearly supporting Wirecard. The German press, the German media, was also very strongly supporting Wirecard. And even to some extent, the German people were supporting Wirecard, because you know there's a bit in the documentary where you talk about how you were getting lots of very random comments from so many people, and I mean there is perhaps an argument to be made that maybe it was a Russian troll farm that was generating these comments, but you know it stands to reason that people were not very happy that you were doing this at all. And why do you think that they were so on side with Wirecard? Why do you think they didn't take your claims seriously at all and didn't even think, hey, well, obviously this guy is making crazy allegations, but we'll take a look anyway. We'll take a closer look.
The short answer is it's very hard to change people's minds when money is at stake. Now, a lot goes on underneath that. And Wirecard was good at astroturfing as well, by the way. And I think it was instructive just how convincing some of these things were. So we would write an article and then there would be lots of comments underneath it saying, "Dan McCrum's an idiot, he should go to jail, Wirecard's great, we love you, Marcus." And the same on Twitter. And we started to look at some of these Twitter people and they looked really convincing. I'm an investor. You know, they're tweeting about tech and everything. And then some of them, we would download their whole history and we discover that actually they'd only picked up tweeting again a couple of months previously. It sort of laid the groundwork with lots of generic tweets and then started tweeting Wirecard talking points. And then you sort of go back through their history and realize 3 years previously, it had been, say, a hair care bot. And all they tweeted about exclusively was hair care products. But they looked super convincing. And it's just that reminder, the people who make the most noise online aren't necessarily the most valid. But that's an aside. Why do people get taken in by these frauds? And I think one good reason is Wirecard have made them rich. If you invested in Wirecard when it was small and suddenly it's the next big thing, you think you're pretty clever. And so it's quite easy in that position to take new information and dismiss it if it doesn't fit what you're expecting. This guy's a genius. He's strutting around like the next big tech titan. Surely he wouldn't be up to no good. And there's this concept called social proof. You assume because, you know, if your friend recommends a builder to you, even if they don't know anything about building, you're going to say, oh, well, good. I don't really know what to believe, but I'll believe my friend. And the same sort of happens at a corporate level. All the brands associated with Wirecard, you know, the auditors, Ernst & Young, one of the world's biggest firms. The regulators seem to be on their side. They had some really big name investors. Banks were lending to them, Commerzbank, Deutsche Bank. And so if you're the guy on the street who's trying to work out what's happening, okay, the Financial Times, we've heard of them, but also there's all these other people over here and surely they wouldn't be involved if this was a fraud.
Right, so I guess it's just this idea of a friend of a friend of a friend eventually, you know, it's almost like a kid's game telephone, right? So eventually you get to this point where everyone is telling you this message and it's just everything is looking good from a distance. So you just think, yeah, everything must be fine.
Well, I don't think it even has to be as strong as that.
Okay.
Because you have to make a decision. What am I going to do with this investment? Real money is involved. You know, it's a pain to take decisions and sell your stock. So you look for a reason to wait and see. I'm not really sure. It all seems very complicated. There's one side and another. You know, I mean, so I feel like a lot of, you know, the German press, for instance, decided, well, this is a fascinating battle. Big newspaper, big company, we'll sit on the sidelines munching popcorn and just report it, you know, like a sports story or something. But I think that also allowed people to go, there's a lot of smoke. I don't really know what's happening. I'll just wait and see. And that serves the fraud.
Right. Okay, that's a really interesting way of putting it. Because I think it's really interesting when you compare that to a lot of the conversations happening in the regulatory industry at the moment, right? Which is that financial institutions, fintechs, regtechs, they should all be getting closer, forming stronger relationships with the regulator. But as Wirecard's story really highlights, that can be quite dangerous at times, right? That can allow for these issues to arise where you have regulators protecting industry where it shouldn't necessarily be doing so. How do you think this issue where BaFin was protecting Wirecard, how do you think that could have been resolved earlier? And how do you think it could have been detected, these issues with Wirecard could have been detected sooner?
Regulatory capture is a real thing. And what is kind of astounding about the Wirecard example is the German regulator, BaFin, was protecting its previous decisions. So when I started writing about Wirecard, I wasn't the first person to voice criticism, to suggest something wasn't right about its numbers. And when that first happened in 2008, BaFin investigated the critics for market manipulation. And I think Wirecard took that as a lesson. This is a very effective way of demonizing people who don't like us. And then BaFin did it again in 2016. investigated some short sellers who tried to expose money laundering by the company. And I think you have this sort of intellectual capture in that they have to justify their previous decisions. But what's astounding to me is the details are slightly complicated, but basically there was this extremely dodgy transaction which Wirecard did in Asia, in India, and everything about it looked off. And one of the people involved realized that this just isn't right. So he went online to Baffin's whistleblowing portal in 2017 and filled in a bunch of details and said, you really need to look closely at this. Money is going to people who it shouldn't. And off it goes to Baffin and nothing happens. So there were also lots of public criticism voiced. So the weird thing that is very, very hard to explain is, why did Baffin ignore all of this?
Yeah, I mean, that really blows my mind because, you know, we have these conversations massively around how companies need to be better with their internal regulations and how it's so easy to dismiss your compliance officers who are raising these internal red flags when, you know, compliance internally is not being heard at the board level, right? The most powerful people making the most powerful decisions in the company and who are focused primarily on profit, they see maybe something slightly confusing or slightly unexplainable happening, but they think, well, we're making millions off of this, so let's not look too closely. I get their reasoning, right? Like, I don't think it's right, but I understand the idea of thinking, hey, this is making me tens of millions, hundreds of millions, let's say, per year. I'm not going to investigate too closely. But the whole point of a regulator is to sit on the other side of that and say, I don't care how much money it's making you. I don't care how good you're making the industry look or the country look or our tech ecosystem look. You need to be compliant. You need to make sure that you're doing the right thing. So there's this really weird and I guess not wonderful moment about how at one point it seems the regulator was almost towing the company line, because again, in the documentary, there was a moment that really spoke to me where a lawyer says something like, German companies don't make mistakes.
So many times. I mean, I've heard it this week at the conference, people saying, you wouldn't expect that of a German company. And then someone pipes up and goes, well, what about Dieselgate? But I think that played into this idea. It's a grown-up country, grown-up institutions. It wouldn't happen here. And all the regulators have these problems and blind spots. I mean, one of the most famous is the SEC over in America, with Harry Markopoulos trying again and again to expose the Madoff fraud. And he was ignored. And so you do see this. This does happen. Which, to my mind, is what's so refreshing about the SEC action against the crypto companies at the moment, which is sort of hilarious. Because they have been saying quite clearly for some time, what you're doing is illegal. You're doing unregistered securities offerings. The law is quite clear. Stop it. And to hear a bunch of people at the conference who are involved in crypto going, why don't they come and talk to us and tell us and say, hey, guys, you really need to stop this out. Or, you know, come and say, we want to regulate you like this. I'm like, why do you want special treatment? Like, the law is quite clear. I mean, they were all written in like the 30s and 40s because of the Great Depression, because of an enormous amount of abuse of regular investors. And you can't just take new technology and do the same thing again and then pretend that the laws don't apply to you. So what is great is to sort of see the regulator slowly but surely reminding everybody that the laws are there.
Yeah, I think you see that a lot with these old settled laws being applied to new technologies. Like, I can't remember the exact details of this, but I remember reading about a crypto company that got done for wire fraud because they were the way they were transacting. But it was a law that was from, I think, pre-60s, right? Like, it was like maybe even a pre-World War II law, that had essentially, they said, well, we don't care that you're doing this with new technology. It's still wire fraud. And I guess you're right. Why should anyone expect any preferential treatment or any sort of unique approach to them just because they're doing something in a new space. It doesn't make sense when what you're still ultimately doing is providing finances to retail investors or retail customers.
Yeah. And there are so many opportunities when regulators could have stopped the Wirecard fraud. Not just the accounting fraud, but Wirecard started out laundering money. It was a payments company. It did high-risk processing, sort of operated in grey areas, and then ended up right in the dark. It was moving money for online gambling in the States by pretending that it was something else, like payments for flowers or golf balls, things like that. And the US government did actually try and investigate it in about 2014, 2015. And the German authorities seized a bunch of information from Wirecard, which then got tied up in court. So the investigation went nowhere. And it sort of speaks to this bigger truth that nobody cares about money laundering. You know, there is this enormous architecture of compliance, of suspicious transaction reports, of everything else that is supposed to be addressing the scourge of our age, you know, moving money around to facilitate crime. And when you get caught with your hand in the till, like HSBC did, is the classic example. The Mexican drug cartel had special boxes made which fit neatly into the windows at the bank branches so that they could push cash through to be banked by HSBC more efficiently. I mean, we're talking industrial scale money laundering. And, you know, HSBC still has a banking license. I don't think anybody went to jail. You know, I'm sure they paid a large fine. And so when you see that, and it's not an existential threat to the business, you know, something as blatant as that doesn't seem to have consequences. You know, most investors don't care about money laundering. And they looked at the Wirecard example, and lots of questions were raised and, you know, very specific allegations made against Wirecard. But because there was no overt regulatory action, I think a lot of professional investors just assumed everything was fine.
I can highly believe that everyone, professional investors, assuming things are fine. I think we've seen lots of stories in the past few years. Firefest was one that comes to mind that was very popular, a guy who managed to raise lots and lots of money. I do have to disagree with you on one point, though.
Oh, go on.
I appreciate why you would say no one cares about money laundering, but in defense of my industry, as someone who works in the AML world, I very much care about money laundering. I know everyone I work with cares, and so do a lot of very hardworking, intelligent people in the industry. I think from an outside of industry perspective, I can completely understand why it might feel that way. But I think there is a lot of internal frustration that people on the inside who work in compliance and who work in AML, they want these changes. They're pushing for those changes. But a sad truth is that the wheels of power move very slowly. Affecting that change is very difficult. I think, you know, if we look at, say, London and the Russia reports, for example, and, you know, what is it? The Russian laundromat is one of the nice ways that people refer to London. These things exist, but it's not that nobody in the industry wants it to change. I think it's that when you're making people a lot of money, it becomes very difficult to say, hey, I need to, you know, kneecap my operation in order to do the right thing. And it's about, for me, it's about putting in those structures to make it so that not only is that the thing that you need to do, it's the thing that you want to do, right? It's the way to operate effectively. Should there be bigger penalties and more personal consequences for people who facilitate money laundering or who don't look into money laundering? Probably. Like, there is a real argument there. I wouldn't ever be able to agree with that.
And again, this frustration is shared because you talk to people in the industry who are taking it seriously. There are huge numbers of people who are putting in place the right processes, who are diligently filing suspicious activity reports, who are doing all the right things. And I guess when I say no one cares, it's shorthand for No one's being prosecuted. Yeah. There just aren't the resources to look at this. And it's tied up as well with, you have a whole bunch of people doing the right thing, and then a not insignificant number who are happy to take the money. And so one of the great things about the Wirecard case is it's a rare opportunity to call out this sort of parasitic layer of respectable London that we call the enablers, the highly paid lawyers, consultants, private detectives, advisors, who will all go into bat for what became clear was just a criminal company, and then go home and sleep very soundly at night in their large mansions.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And there is, I mean, for any journalists who are listening, a fun task for you one day might be to send an email to the top 100 law firms, accountancy firms, company formation firms, and say, hey, I'm working for a client who's doing something, I don't know, pick your crime, and needs to hide X amount of money. And there is an element, there is a fraction of those people and of those companies who I base that on something that was done in a study by a anti-financial crime think tank a long time ago, who asked that I never name them whenever talking about this. And they found people responding in the affirmative multiple times. So yes, I understand. And that's where the frustration is, right? It's like, even if 90% of people are on side and don't want crime to happen, if 10% have infiltrated that industry or that environment, you just need to find that 10% as a criminal and you're golden, right? And they're all going to know each other and be able to put you in contact with people who will help you facilitate the other parts of your company formation or the documents that you need written up or the actual money movement or the shell company you need to be funneling it through. So yeah, I get that element of frustration there. But I wanted to move on to a second, just because this is a very huge story in many ways, but it's also a really personal story for you in particular. And there were many interesting and thought-provoking moments in your documentary, but one of the ones that I found most poignant was a moment where you got really human and vulnerable for a second on screen, and you said, you were talking about your son, and you said how you were under threat and you were concerned about your family, and you said, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, he's 3 years old, who wants to do that to a 3 year old? And yeah, who does, right? It's a child, someone who is essentially means everything to you, knowing that you're under threat in a very real way, not in a way where, as far as I understand it, no one ever outright said to you something bad was going to happen to you, but being under constant surveillance, being harassed, being told, oh, essentially that someone knows everything about your movements and the way you spend your money and, I don't know, where you pick up a Friday night takeaway to have with the family. Like, that's going to be a really difficult moment mentally. And how did you handle that?
In the film, they pop up a picture of my son when he, I think it was a day or two after he was born, and always almost brings a tear to the eye because it just puts me back in that moment of fear that was all this sort of unspoken threat that something might happen and you didn't know what. But I've been warned right at the beginning, gangsters in the room are involved, and you just dismiss that blithely. You know, you get the journalistic protection. If something happened to me, I always assumed the police can be far more interested than some esoteric financial matter. But as the noise increases and sort of the stress builds up, and I'm being sued by Wirecard, the German police were investigating me, I had both this sense that if something happened to me, like, you know, I get knocked off my bike, or, you know, hit by a van crossing the road, it would both be very convenient for a lot of people. And also maybe people would shrug and go, well, clearly he was mixed up in some nasty business, got what he deserved. And that was quite hard to deal with. It's quite hard to explain that sort of living with that paranoia. And it was quite hard to accept that you had sort of brought it on yourself and your family. And it was one of the things I was trying to bring out when I was writing Money Men, was I wanted to put some of my family in there and sort of contrast these moments. So there's this point where I go and meet the whistleblower for the first time, and he gives me the cache of documents, and I know this is explosive. This is potentially the thing which could finally cause the company to unravel. You know, this sort of miraculous big break. And so I fly to Singapore, meet him in total hush-hush secretly. And then I come back and I'm sort of, my family don't care. It's my son's birthday. And we sort of have to put that down. And we have a birthday party with fireworks and we're all having a great time. And it's just the contrast in resources and sort of thing. This is like, I'm just a guy trying to live my life. And how do you tell your neighbours that a financial institution is out to get you? It's a very weird place to be.
Yeah, that's got to be incredibly strange. If it helps, I wouldn't categorize it as paranoia myself. I think if people are surveilling you, then that's just safety.
Yeah, you might be paranoid, but they are out to get you.
Yeah, I think for me, that's more someone being very safety conscious. But thank you for sharing that. I know that wasn't easy. But it's really strange how you have to juggle those two very separate worlds. It's almost like something out of like an old John Le Carré novel, right? Like John Le Carré, sorry. Like this whole spy world / gangster world, and then nice family, fun times, good times happening at the same time. It's got to be incredibly strange.
It really did feel like we were in a spy novel, because it's sort of the story starts out normal enough, cat and mouse trying to expose the company. And then suddenly you realize, hang on, who are these guys friends with? And like one of the main characters is this guy, Jan Marslek. And he is, we realize, the brains of the operation. They called him Wirecard's chaotic genius. And he's the one who's spinning the plates behind the scenes and coming up with all the crazy schemes inside the company. But while he's a finance executive by day, by night it turns out he has all these other interests. And he's hanging out with Russian mercenaries and Libyan spies. And he's trying to put together a border force in North Africa. And I mean, our minds slightly exploded at that point, and you start to think, holy mackerel, are these guys protected? What is really going on here? So yeah, that's the point where the story starts to go completely mad.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very wild moment when I was reading about this. But just to go back for a second, these are clearly tactics that have been well worn. They very clearly knew exactly what they were doing. Do you have any real sense of how many other stories they've killed this way, or any other journalists they've successfully intimidated in this sort of way?
I think this is something that happens. We were very lucky. We had a very experienced editor who was prepared to take risks. We had the resources of the Financial Times. And also, we had trust. The main editor really trusted my direct editor, Paul Murphy, who's this brilliant character in himself, this old school hack with all these dodgy London sources, and couldn't have done it without either of them. And I think there aren't many organisations with the resources and the ability to sort of stand up to that kind of legal bullying, the other threats. I have heard of circumstances of being journalists being threatened. I mean, the Committee to Protect Journalists talks about, how many journalists around the world are killed every year. So I'm just doing like finance stories. This was quite unusual. There are people in genuine peril out there. And so, yeah, I think a lot of stories do get killed or shoved under the carpet through intimidation.
You talked about trust there for a second as well, and trust was a really key part of the entire story, right? Baffin's trust in Wirecard, the Financial Times' trust in you, your editor's trust in you, and I found one of the things that I found really difficult to understand was that as a Brit, as someone who grew up in the UK, the Financial Times to me has always been the paragon of journalistic integrity. And sure, you might not like what they're saying, or they might be a little bit to whatever political bias you like on a particular story. But by and large, you know, you could trust everything that's coming out of the Financial Times. It's what businessmen read, you know, when I was growing up. That was a thing. Mm-hmm. This is the news of business people. This is how they make decisions to move money across the world and how they, you know, protect the economy and build the economy. Was there any part of you a little bit, I don't know, flabbergasted at the prospect that you were being cast as this dishonest and untruthful person?
I think we're in the era of the corrosive big lie. Fake news. Trump didn't start it, but he certainly gave it life. This idea that you can't trust any news organization, mainstream media. So it was a little bit of a shock to find out that people would read articles in the Financial Times and would just go, oh, I guess they've given their pages over to this one corrupt reporter and think that was completely normal. But on the other hand, I think it's part of this bigger picture, you know, eroding trust in institutions. Yes, I think the Financial Times is one of the more trusted news brands. But you do have to remember, people fundamentally don't trust journalists. There are some very long-running surveys in the UK of attitudes towards different professions, and journalists usually feature somewhere with politicians and estate agents.
Okay. Oh, I mean, that just reminded me of something when I was a kid, when it was there was this list of, like, everyone liked to trot out of, oh, the top jobs if you're most likely to have if you're a psychopath, and number one was a CEO, and then it was a surgeon, and then lawyer, and then doctor, and then journalist was always like number five on the list. And I always remember just thinking, I don't think that's true. But you're right. There is this pervasive distrust of journalists. So I guess maybe that was just what they hung this story on, right? This great thing of don't trust anything that you're shown, or don't trust anything you're told, especially if a journalist is telling it to you. And so it's interesting how that sort of societal proof comes into play.
Yeah, I mean, you do have to explain Piers Morgan somehow.
Okay, very fair. But what do you think? So now, I mean, the story has essentially come to a close. You release the, I guess, what was it? They send the documentary. You drew blood with your story, and essentially Wirecard is dismantled. What do you think the real benefits have been from Wirecard essentially crashing to zero value? I know a lot of their assets and licenses in APAC have recently been reformed into a payments company. I don't know what that actually really means for the future of that company. But what did Wirecard actually have in Asia? Because as far as I can tell from the documentary, it was a dog grooming business.
So that is one of the if you haven't seen it, the dog grooming is one of the best bits in the film. And I don't want to give away a spoiler, but just it's a treat when you get to it. Let's talk about the Asian business, because that's really interesting to me. Because the thing to understand about Wirecard is it went through this period of growing very quickly. It claimed it was growing very quickly by buying up businesses all over Asia. And then it wouldn't do anything with them. It would just leave them alone, wouldn't integrate them, and none of them were any good businesses. I've seen the internal financials from sort of 2016, 2017, and pretty much they're all losing money. And that was what was the breakthrough, was actually the small frauds that were being done to make these businesses look profitable so that they wouldn't attract the attention of auditors. So the idea that you would take that and there would be some brilliant payments business underlying it is a bit weird to me. And then the other thing Wirecard did in Asia was it bought Citi's payment processing customer list. So it didn't buy the whole business from Citi. It basically just bought its pure payment processing operation. Pretty much just took the customers off them. And when you step back, That makes no sense whatsoever. Because if you're a full service bank, you do lots of different things. And one of the ways you attract customers is give them cheap payments processing, because you're also going to run their cash accounts and sell them loans and do all sorts of fun advisory work. So payments processing is a bit of a loss leader. So the idea that you could take that and it would be a good business on its own, and Wirecard never managed to make it a decent business, and they were trying to get a bunch of licenses around Asia. Now, maybe there is value in having some payments licenses. You know, it's better than not having a license. But I'd be very curious as to how the remains of Wirecard really adds up to much of anything.
That's really interesting. I really like what you said about it's better to have licenses than not to have licenses. They had these licenses, but it didn't mean they were compliant at all with them, really.
Well, yes.
You know, so I guess it's a good cautionary tale to constantly be, as for regulators anyway, to constantly be checking in on these lines and making sure that those standards are being met.
And in the big picture, after Wirecard, I mean, it focused a lot of attention on auditing, on regulation, on just general tech investments. I think Wirecard was part of the thing which punctured this blue sky thinking of everything's going to be great, and just look at the total addressable market. How big could it possibly be? You know, that big tech enthusiasm that drove a bubble for a while. But what was also really interesting was when Wirecard went down, particularly in the UK, a whole bunch of fintech businesses ran into problems overnight when the FCA momentarily stopped Wirecard's license. And what you discovered is there was a surprising number of fintech businesses which were basically a prepaid card rebadged in some interesting way. And I think regulators really did start to pay attention to that.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. And I think there is discussion to be had around how some of fintech is essentially good branding with an old product, or with a slightly new spin on an old product. But I guess that's the kind of the beauty of fintech to some degree, in my eyes, is that sometimes you take a product and you just find a new way to make it appealing to your core audience. Preferably not underlied by a giant fraud.
Well, yes. Generally, you know, you like to start out without the giant fraud.
Yeah, exactly. But what do you think it takes to spot the next Wirecard? Because this isn't going to be by any means the last instance of a company being created to perpetrate a fraud, right? How do you think? And Wirecard became huge, right? They had a beautiful, massive building everywhere, and they really built momentum. How can you stop the next company, who is essentially a giant shell, from becoming such a force in the industry?
Let me give you two things to look out for. One general and one specific. The specific one is Wirecard was growing very quickly, said it was really profitable, produced loads of cash, but every year the amount of its debt went up. And when you step back and think about it with hindsight, you go, that's a bit weird. And had people looked at that and some other metrics, they might have gone, hang on, this thing's too good to be true, isn't it? Something isn't quite right. The thing that I always like to say is there's this saying amongst short sellers, there's never just one cockroach in the kitchen. So if you find a company lying about one thing, well, I guess there's probably some other lies hiding underneath the fridge as well.
I think that's a really great way to look at it. You're right. It's never money laundering as a whole, right? It's never just one thing. It's always a network of things, a web of things all interconnecting and building up a much bigger picture. In fact, I think, to be honest, I think that's the activity that underlies and describes money laundering better than anything else. Just to take a step back from Wirecard as daily operations, when you were investigating, what really made the difference was who was behind Wirecard, these major companies in three different cities and across the world. Essentially, the people who were ultimately benefiting from Wirecard's... Sorry. It's a little bit different from what's happened recently in the EU, but there is a thing called, there is a concept called ultimate beneficial owner in anti-money activity. And that's essentially who owns, who profits on any given business. And this register, these registers are supposed to exist in every EU country, really in every country. And the plan was for that to be available publicly. However, now it's only really available to financial institutions, I believe, and registered and regulated entities to carry out anti-money laundering investigations. But I think that means that journalists no longer have access to this, thanks to the European Data Protection Board coming out against it on GDPR grounds.
So what happened was, and I'm glad you brought this up, because it is a disaster for journalism and for the public. There was this court case, I think, brought by the owner of a chartered jet airline who has a weird number of corporate entities. And he challenged something that had happened. And the upshot of it was, sort of out of nowhere, this European judge basically said privacy grounds meant that the Luxembourg corporate registry couldn't publish beneficial ownership data. And it's total, absolute, I would like to swear, madness. Because the judge doesn't really seem to understand the purpose of this. It's not a private matter having a limited company. And I think one of the things that everyone should realize is that a limited company structure, which means you can start a business and you can take risks, but if it fails, you only lose what is in the company. You're not bankrupting yourself. That is an incredibly valuable thing to have in society. It means you can take risks and you can start businesses. It's the driving engine of capitalism. And it's a privilege. You are given this wonderful benefit that you can take risks without being bankrupted. And you can start a limited company. And with that privilege should come obligations. To say who you are, to say who owns this business, to publish accounts. These are pretty basic things which aren't examined very often because we didn't think we had to. And some judges come along and said, oh, no, no, this is all private. And I think if we don't watch out, we'll end up in the route like the US, which, for all its much vaunted capitalism and everything else, is a black hole of information. We'll be like Delaware, where nobody knows anything about companies and it's impossible to do the sort of journalistic digging that you try to do here.
Yeah, I think that's the real worry, right? Especially for the EU generally. I think there's some value in the fact that financial institutions have access to it at least, so at least the data exists in some way. Personally, I believe in a free and strong press. I would love, and also just for my own self-gratification, right? I would love to be able to investigate these things myself and take a look without having to, you know, go through a very arduous process as an employee of a financial institution. But I have one major question for you, just because I realize it's been a bit of a conversation. What do you think is next for finance, for the financial industry, in the wake of all of these scandals that we're seeing at the moment? Like, Wirecard is really the tip of the iceberg.
Interesting time right now. You have an administration in the US which is putting forward, I think, a different and some would say better agenda than that which preceded it. You are seeing a reckoning with some of the excesses of zero interest rates and people trying not to get caught out, you know, doing the checks that they didn't do before Wirecard. So, we're not, everything is in flux. And I think we haven't flushed out all of the excesses of a decade of free money yet. So, I can't really tell you where we're going, but I do know it is going to be very interesting.
I agree. I think we're in for some really interesting times ahead as well. Dan, thank you so much for joining me. If anyone in the audience wants to find you or get in touch with you, where can they do that online?
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm on Twitter at FD. LinkedIn is great. Dan McCrum, I'm very easy to find. And LinkedIn is also brilliant for people getting in touch in a way that isn't using their corporate email, I would always advise you not to link your LinkedIn account to your work email address, because then it gives you a non-work monitored means of communication if, for instance, you wanted to leak useful information to a journalist.
Brilliant. Thanks all. Thank you for listening to this episode of Finogo FinTalks. I'm Dan Nursigadu, and I've been joined by Dan McCrum, investigative reporter at the Financial Times. Make sure to subscribe to the show. It's available wherever you choose to get your podcasts, and you can always find us at finogo.com.